I am Captain Dantès, a loyal Frenchman, though accused of treason. Tell me where you are conducting me, and I promise you, on my honour, I will submit to my fate." The gendarme looked irresolutely at his companion, who returned for answer a sigh that said, "I see no great harm in telling him now." And the gendarme replied, "You are a native of Marseille and a sailor, and yet you do not know where you are going. On my honour, I have no idea." "That is impossible. I swear to you it is true. Tell me, I entreat, but my orders. Your orders do not forbid your telling me what I must know in 10 minutes, in half an hour, or an hour. You see, I cannot escape even if I intended. Unless you are blind, or have never been outside the harbour, you must know." "I do not." "Look around you, then." Dantès rose and looked forward, when he saw rise within 100 yards of him the black and frowning rock on which stands the Château d'If. This gloomy fortress, which has for more than 300 years furnished food for so many wild legends, seemed to Dantès like a scaffold to a malefactor. "The Château d'If!" cried he. "What are we going there for?" The gendarme smiled. "I am not going there to be imprisoned," said Dantès. "It is only used for political prisoners. I have committed no crime. Are there any magistrates or judges at the Château d'If?"
"There are only," said the gendarme, "a governor, a garrison, turnkeys, and good thick walls." "Come, come, do not look so astonished, or you will make me think you are laughing at me in return for my good nature." Dantès pressed the gendarme's hand, as though he would crush it.
"You think, then," said he, "that I am conducted to the Château to be imprisoned there?"
"It is probable, but there is no occasion to squeeze so hard, without any formality." "All the formalities have been gone through,
in spite of Monsieur de Villefort's promises?"
"I do not know what Monsieur de Villefort promised you," said the gendarme, "but I know we are taking you to the Château d'If."
"But what are you doing? Help, comrades, help!"
By a rapid movement which the gendarme's practiced eye had perceived, Dantès sprang forward to precipitate himself into the sea, but 4 vigorous arms seized him as his feet quitted the flooring of the boat. He fell back, foaming with rage.
"Good," said the gendarme, placing his knee on his chest. "Believe soft-spoken gentleman again. Hark ye, my friend, I have disobeyed my first order, but I will not disobey the second, and if you move, I lodge a bullet in your brain."
And he levelled his carbine at Dantès, who felt the muzzle touch his head. For a moment the idea of struggling crossed his mind, and so end the unexpected evil that had overtaken him. But he bethought him of Monsieur de Villefort's promise, and besides, death in a boat from the hand of a gendarme seemed too terrible. He remained motionless, but gnashing his teeth with fury. At this moment a violent shock made the bark tremble. One of the sailors leaped on shore, a cord creaked as it ran through a pulley, and Dantès guessed they were at the end of the voyage. His guardians, taking hold of his arms, forced him to rise, and dragged him towards the steps that led to the gate of the fortress, while the exempt followed, armed with a carbine and bayonet. Dantès made no resistance. He was like a man in a dream. He saw soldiers who stationed themselves on the sides. He felt himself forced up fresh stairs. He perceived he passed through a door, and the door closed behind him, but all this as mechanically as through a mist, nothing distinctly. They halted for a minute, during which he strove to collect his thoughts. He looked around. He was in a court surrounded by high walls. He heard the measured tread of sentinels, and as they passed before the light he saw the barrels of their muskets shine. They waited upwards of 10 minutes. Captain Dantès could not escape. The gendarmes released him. They seemed awaiting orders. The orders arrived.
"Where is the prisoner?" said a voice.
"Here," replied the gendarmes. "Let him follow me. I'm going to conduct him to his room."
"Go," said the gendarmes, pushing Dantès.
The prisoner followed his conductor, who led him into a room almost underground, whose bare and reeking walls seemed as though impregnated with tears. A lamp, placed on a stool, illumined the apartment faintly, and showed Dantès the features of his conductor, an under-jailer, ill-clothed and of sullen appearance.
"Here is your chamber for tonight," said he. "It is late, and Monsieur le Gouverneur is asleep. Tomorrow, perhaps, he may change you. In the meantime, there is bread, water, and fresh straw, and that is all a prisoner can wish for. Good night." and before Dantès could open his mouth, before he had noticed where the jailer placed his bread or the water, before he had glanced towards the corner where the straw was, the jailer disappeared, taking with him the lamp. Dantès was alone in darkness and in silence, cold as the shadows that he felt breathe on his burning forehead. With the first dawn of day, the jailer returned, with orders to leave Dantès where he was. He found the prisoner in the same position, as if fixed there, his eyes swollen with weeping. He had passed the night standing and without sleep. The jailer advanced. Dantès appeared not to perceive him. He touched him on the shoulder. Edmund started. "Have you not slept?" said the jailer. "I do not know," replied Dantès. The jailer stared. "Are you hungry?" continued he. "I do not know." "Do you wish for anything?" "I wish to see the governor." The jailer shrugged his shoulders and left the chamber. Dantès followed him with his eyes and stretched forth his hands towards the open door, but the door closed. All his emotion then burst forth. He cast himself on the ground, weeping bitterly, and asking himself what crime he had committed that he was thus punished. The day passed thus. He scarcely tasted food, but walked round and round the cell like a wild beast in its cage. One thought in particular tormented him, namely, that during his journey hither he had sat so still, whereas he might a dozen times have plunged into the sea, and thanks to his powers of swimming, for which he was famous, have gained the shore, concealed himself until the arrival of a Genoese or Spanish vessel, escaped to Spain or Italy, where Mercedes and his father could have joined him. He had no fears as to how he should live. Good seamen are welcome everywhere. He spoke Italian like a Tuscan and Spanish like a Castilian. He would then have been happy, whereas he was now confined in the Chateau d'If, ignorant of the future destiny of his father and Mercedes, and all this because he had trusted to Villefort's promise. The thought was maddening, and Dantès threw himself furiously down on his straw. The next morning, the jailer made his appearance. "Well," said the jailer, "are you more reasonable today?" Dantès made no reply. "Come, take courage. Do you want anything in my power to do for you?" "I wish to see the governor." "I have already told you it was impossible." "Why so?" "Because it is not allowed by the rules." "What is allowed then?" "Better fare, if you pay for it. Books and leave to walk about." "I do not want books. I am satisfied with my food, and I do not care to walk about. But I wish to see the governor. If you worry me by repeating the same thing, I will not bring you any more to eat." "Well then," said Edmund, "if you do not, I shall die of famine, that is all." The jailer saw by his tone he would be happy to die, and as every prisoner is worth sixpence a day to his jailer, he replied in a more subdued tone, "What you ask is impossible. But if you are very well behaved, you will be allowed to walk about, and some day you will meet the governor, and if he chooses to reply, that is his affair." "But," asked Dantès, "how long shall I have to wait?" "Oh, a month, 6 months, a year? It is too long a time. I wish to see him at once." "Ah," said the jailer, "do not always brood over what is impossible, or you will be mad in a fortnight." "You think so?" "Yes. We have an instance here. It was by always offering 1,000,000 francs to the governor for his liberty that an abbé became mad, who was in this chamber before you." "How long has he left it?" "2 years." "Was he liberated then?" "No. He was put in a dungeon." "Listen," said Dantès, "I am not an abbé. I am not mad. Perhaps I shall be, but at present, unfortunately, I am not. I will make you another offer." "What is that?" "I do not offer you 1,000,000, because I have it not. But I will give you 100 crowns if the first time you go to Marseille you will seek out a young girl named Mercedes at the Catalans, and give her 2 lines from me. If I took them and were detected, I should lose my place, which is worth 2,000 francs a year, so that I should be a great fool to run such a risk for 300. "Well," said Dantès, "mark this. If you refuse at least to tell Mercedes I am here, I will some day hide myself behind the door, and when you enter, I will dash out your brains with this stool." "Threats?" cried the jailer, retreating and putting himself on the defensive. "You are certainly going mad. The abbe began like you, and in 3 days you will want a straight waistcoat. But fortunately, there are dungeons here." Dantes whirled the stool round his head. "Oh," said the jailer, "you shall see the governor at once." "That is right," returned Dantes, dropping the stool and sitting on it as if he were in reality mad. The jailer went out and returned in an instant with a corporal and 4 soldiers. "By the governor's orders," said he, "conduct the prisoner to the story beneath." "To the dungeon, then," said the corporal. "Yes, we must put the madman with the mad men." The soldier seized Dantes, who followed passively. He descended 15 steps, and the door of a dungeon was opened, and he was thrust in. The door closed, and Dantes advanced with outstretched hands until he touched the wall. He then sat down in the corner until his eyes became accustomed to the darkness. The jailer was right. Dantes wanted but little of being utterly mad. 9. The Evening of the Betrothal. Villefort had, as we have said, hastened back to the Place du Grand Cours, and on entering the house found all the guests in the salon at coffee. René was, with all the rest of the company, anxiously awaiting him, and his entrance was followed by a general exclamation.
"Well, decapitator, guardian of the state, Brutus, what is the matter?" said one.
"Are we threatened with a fresh reign of terror?" asked another. "Has the Corsican ogre broke loose?" cried a third.
"Madame la Marquise," said Villefort, approaching his future mother-in-law, "I request your pardon for thus leaving you. Monsieur le Marquis, honour me by a few moments' private conversation."
"Ah, this affair is really serious, then?" asked the Marquis, remarking the cloud on Villefort's brow.
"So serious that I must take leave of you for a few days. So," added he, turning to René, "judge for yourself if it be not important."
"You are going to leave us?" cried René, unable to hide her emotion.
"Alas," returned Villefort, "I must."
"Where, then, are you going?" asked the Marquise.
"That, madame, is the secret of justice. But if you have any commissions for Paris, a friend of mine is going there tonight." The guests looked at each other.
"You wish to speak to me alone?" said the Marquis.
"Yes, let us go into your cabinet." The Marquis took his arm and left the salon.
"Well," asked he, as soon as they were in his closet, "tell me, what is it? An affair of the greatest importance that demands my immediate presence in Paris. Now, excuse the indiscretion, Marquis, but have you any funded property?"
"All my fortune is in the funds, 700,000 or 800,000 francs.
"Then sell out. Sell out, Marquis, as soon as you can."
"Eh? How can I sell out here?"
"You have a broker, have you not?"
"Yes." "Then give me a letter to him, and tell him to sell out without an instant's delay. Perhaps even now I shall arrive too late."
"What say you?" said the Marquis. "Let us lose no time, then." And sitting down, he wrote a letter to his broker, ordering him to sell out at any loss.
"Now then," said Villefort, placing the letter in his pocket-book, "write another."
"To whom?"
"To the king."
"I dare not write to His Majesty. I do not ask you to write to His Majesty, but ask Monsieur de Salvieux to do so. I want a letter that will enable me to reach the king's presence without all the formalities of demanding an audience that would occasion a loss of time. But address yourself to the keeper of the seals. He has the right of entry and can procure you audience."
"Doubtless, but there is no occasion to divide the merit of my discovery with him. The keeper would leave me in the background and take all the honour to himself. I tell you, Marquis, my fortune is made if I only reach the Tuileries the first, for the king will not forget the service I do him."
"In that case, make your preparations, and I will write the letter. Be as quick as possible. I must be en route in a quarter of an hour. Make your carriage stop at the door. You will present my excuses to the Marquise and Mademoiselle René, whom I leave on such a day with great regret. They are both in my room. You can say all this for yourself."
1,000 thanks. Busy yourself with the letter."
The Marquis rang. A servant entered. "Inform the Comte de Salvieux I am waiting for him."
"Now then, go," said the Marquis.
"I only go for a few moments."
Vifor hastily quitted the apartment, but reflecting that the sight of the deputy procureur running through the streets would be enough to throw the whole city into confusion, he resumed his ordinary pace. At his door he perceived a figure in the shadow that seemed to wait for him. It was Mercedes, who, hearing no news of her lover, had come herself to inquire after him. As Vifor drew near, she advanced and stood before him. Dantès had spoken of his bride, and Villefort instantly recognized her. Her beauty and high bearing surprised him, and when she inquired what had become of her lover, it seemed to him that she was the judge and he the accused. "The young man you speak of," said Villefort abruptly, "is a great criminal, and I can do nothing for him, mademoiselle." Mercedes burst into tears, and as Villefort strove to pass her, again addressed him. "But at least, tell me where he is, that I may learn if he is alive or dead," said she. "I do not know. He is no longer in my hands," replied Villefort. And desirous of putting an end to the interview, he pushed by her and closed the door, as if to exclude the pain he felt. But remorse is not thus banished. Like the wounded hero of Virgil, Arrow remained in the wound, and, arrived at the salon, Villefort, in his turn, burst into tears and sank into a chair. The man he sacrificed to his ambition, that innocent victim he made pay the penalty of his father's faults, appeared to him pale and threatening, leading his affianced bride by the hand, and bringing with him remorse not such as the ancients figured, furious and terrible, but that slow and consuming agony whose pangs cease only with life. Then he had a moment's hesitation. He had frequently called for capital punishment on criminals, and owing to his irresistible eloquence they had been condemned, and yet the slightest shadow of remorse had never clouded Villefort's brow, because they were guilty, at least he believed so. But here was an innocent man whose happiness he had destroyed. In this case he was not the judge, but the executioner. As he thus reflected, he felt the sensation we have described, and which had hitherto been unknown to him, arise in his bosom and fill him with vague apprehensions. It is thus that a wounded man trembles instinctively at the approach of the finger to his wound, until it be healed. But Villefort's was one of those that never close, or if they do, only close to reopen more agonizing than ever. If, at this moment, the sweet voice of Renée had sounded in his ears, pleading for mercy, or the fair Mercedes had entered and said, "In the name of God I conjure you to restore me my affianced husband," his cold and trembling hands would have signed his release. But no voice broke the stillness of the chamber, and the door was opened only by Villefort's valet, who came to tell him the travelling carriage was in readiness. Villefort rose, or rather sprang, from his chair, hastily opened one of the drawers of his secretaire, emptied all the gold it contained into his pocket, stood motionless an instant, his hand pressed to his head, muttered a few inarticulate sounds, and then, perceiving his servant had placed his cloak on his shoulders, he sprang into the carriage, ordering the postilions to go Rue de Grandcourt to the house of Monsieur de Saint-Mérin. As the Marquis had promised, Villefort found the letter. He started when he saw Renée, for he fancied she was again about to plead for Dantès. Alas, she was thinking only of Villefort's departure. She loved Villefort, and he left her at the moment he was about to become her husband. Villefort knew not when he should return, and Renée, far from pleading for Dantès, hated the man whose crime separated her from her lover. What had Mercedes to say? Mercedes had met Fernand at the corner of the Rue de la Loge. She had returned to the Catalans, and had despairingly cast herself on her couch. Fernand, kneeling by her side, took her hand and covered it with kisses that Mercedes did not even feel. She passed the night thus, and the day returned without her noticing it. Grief had made her blind to all but one object, that was Edmund.
"Ah, you are there," said she at length.
"I have not quitted you since yesterday," returned Fernand sorrowfully. Monsieur Morel had learned that Dantès had been conducted to prison, and he had gone to all his friends and the influential persons of the city, but the report was already in circulation that Dantès was arrested as a Bonapartist agent. And as the most sanguine looked upon any attempt of Napoleon to remount the throne as impossible, he met with nothing but refusal, and had returned home in despair. Caderousse was equally restless and uneasy, but instead of seeking to aid Dantès, he had shut himself up with two bottles of wine in the hope of drowning reflection.
But he did not succeed, and became too intoxicated to fetch any more wine, and yet not so intoxicated as to forget what had happened. Danglars alone was content and joyous. He had got rid of an enemy and preserved his situation on board the Pharaon. Danglars was one of those men born with a pen behind the ear and an inkstand in place of a heart. Everything with him was multiplication or subtraction, and he estimated the life of a man as less precious than a figure when that figure could increase and that life would diminish the total of the amount. Villefort, after having received Monsieur de Salvieux's letter, embraced René, kissed the Marquise's hand, and shaken hands with the Marquis, started for Paris. Old Dantès was dying with anxiety to know what had become of Edmond. 10. The little room in the Tuileries. We will leave Villefort on the road to Paris, travelling with all speed, and, penetrating the two or three apartments which precede it, enter the small cabinet of the Tuileries with the arched window, so well known as having been the favourite cabinet of Napoleon and Louis XVIII, as also that of Louis Philippe. There, in this closet, seated before a walnut tree table he had brought with him from Hartwell, and to which, from one of those fancies not uncommon to great people, he was particularly attached, the king, Louis XVIII, was carelessly listening to a man of 50 or 52 years of age, with grey hairs, aristocratic bearing, and exceedingly gentlemanly attire, whilst he was making a note in a volume of Horace, Griffius's edition, which was much indebted to the sagacious observations of the philosophical monarch.
"You say, sir," said the king, "that I am exceedingly disquieted, sire. Really? Have you had a visit of the 7 fat kine and 7 lean kine? No, sire, for that would only betoken for us 7 years of plenty and 7 years of scarcity, and with a king as full of foresight as your majesty, scarcity is not a thing to be feared. Then of what other scourge are you afraid, my dear Blacas? Sire, I have every reason to believe that a storm is brewing in the south." "Well, my dear Duke," replied Louis XVIII, "I think you are wrongly informed, and know positively that, on the contrary, it is very fine weather in that direction." Man of ability as he was, Louis XVIII liked a pleasant jest. "Sire," continued Monsieur de Blacas, "if it only be to reassure a faithful servant, will your majesty send into Languedoc, Provence, and Dauphine trusty men who will bring you back a faithful report as to the feeling in these 3 provinces?"
"Canimus Serdis," replied the king, continuing the annotations in his Horace.
"Sire," replied the courtier, laughing in order that he might seem to comprehend the quotation, "your majesty may be perfectly right in relying on the good feeling of France, but I fear I am not altogether wrong in dreading some desperate attempt."
"By whom?"
"By Bonaparte, or at least his party."
"My dear Blacas," said the king, "you with your alarms prevent me from working, and you, sire, prevent me from sleeping with your security. Wait, my dear sir, wait a moment, for I have such a delightful note on the pastor cum traheret. Wait, and I will listen to you afterwards."
There was a brief pause, during which Louis XVIII wrote, in a hand as small as possible, another note on the margin of his Horace, and then, looking at the Duke with the air of a man who thinks he has an idea of his own, whilst he is but commenting upon the idea of another, he said,
"Go on, my dear Duke, go on, I listen."
"Sire," said Blacas, who had for a moment the hope of sacrificing Villefort to his own profit, "I am compelled to tell you that these are not mere rumours, destitute of foundation, which thus disquiet me, but a reflective man deserving all my confidence and charged by me to watch over the south." The Duke hesitated as he pronounced these words, "has arrived post to tell me a great peril threatens the king, and then I hasten to you, sire."
"Mala duces affi domum," continued Louis XVIII, still annotating.
Does your majesty wish me to cease as to this subject?
By no means, dear duke, but just stretch out your hand.
Which?
Whichever you please. There, to the left.
Here, sire, I tell you to the left, and you seek the right. I mean on my right.
Yes, there. You will find the report of the Minister of Police of yesterday.
But here is Monsieur Dandré himself.
And Monsieur Dandré, announced by the Chamberlain in waiting, entered.
Come in, said Louis XVIII, with an imperceptible smile. Come in, Baron, and tell the Duke all you know. The latest news of Monsieur de Bonaparte. Do not conceal anything, however serious. Let us see, the island of Elba is a volcano, and we may expect to have issuing thence flaming and bristling war.
Bella, horrider Bella.
Monsieur Dandré leaned very respectfully on the back of a chair with his two hands and said,
Has your majesty perused yesterday's report?
Yes, yes, but tell the duke himself, who cannot find anything, what the report contains. Give him the particulars of what the usurper is doing in his islet.
Monsieur, said the baron to the duke, all the servants of his majesty must approve of the latest intelligence which we have from the island of Elba.
Bonaparte, Monsieur Dandré looked at Louis XVIII, who, employed in writing a note, did not even raise his head.
Bonaparte, continued the baron, is mortally wearied, and passes whole days in watching his miners at work at Porta Longone.
And scratches himself for amusement, added the king.
Scratches himself? Inquired the duke. What does your majesty mean?
Yes, indeed, my dear duke. Did you forget that this great man, this hero, this demigod, is attacked with a malady of the skin which worries him to death, prurigo?
And moreover, Monsieur le Duc, continued the Minister of Police, we are almost assured that in a very short time the usurper will be insane.
Insane?
Insane to a degree. His head becomes weaker. Sometimes he weeps bitterly, sometimes laughs boisterously. At other times he passes hours on the seashore flinging stones in the water, and when the flint makes duck and drake 5 or 6 times, he appears as delighted as if he had gained another Marengo or Austerlitz. Now you must agree, these are indubitable symptoms of weakness.
Or of wisdom, Monsieur le Baron.
Or of wisdom, said Louis XVIII, laughing. The greatest captains of antiquity recreated themselves with casting pebbles into the ocean. See Plutarch's Life of Scipio Africanus.
Monsieur de Blacas pondered deeply in this blind repose of monarch and minister. Vifor, who did not choose to reveal the whole secret, lest another should reap all the benefit of the disclosure, had yet communicated enough to cause him the greatest uneasiness.
"'Well, well, Dandré,' said Louis XVIII, "'Blacas is not yet convinced. "'Let us proceed, therefore, to the usurper's conversion.'
"'The Minister of Police bowed.
"'The usurper's conversion?' murmured the Duke, "'looking at the King and Dandré, "'who spoke alternately like Virgil's shepherds. "'The usurper converted?'
"'Decidedly, my dear Duke.
"'In what way converted? "'To good principles.'
Explain all about it, Baron.
Why, this it is, Monsieur le Duc, said the minister with the gravest air in the world. Napoleon lately had a review, and as 2 or 3 of his old veterans testified a desire to return to France, he gave them their dismissal and exhorted them to serve the good king. These were his own words, Monsieur le Duc, I am certain of that.
Well, Blacas, what think you of this?
Inquired the king triumphantly, and pausing for a moment from the voluminous scholiast before him.
I say, sire, that the Minister of Police is greatly deceived, or I am, and as it is impossible it can be the Minister of Police, as he has the guardianship of the safety and honour of your majesty, it is probable I am in error. However, sire, if I might advise... Your Majesty will interrogate the person of whom I spoke to you, and I will urge Your Majesty to do him this honour.
Most willingly, Duke. Under your auspices I will receive any person you please, but with arms in hand.
Monsieur le Ministre, have you any report more recent than this, dated the 20th February, and this is the 4th of March?
No, sire, but I am hourly expecting one. It may have arrived since I left my office.
Go thither, and if there be none, well, continued Louis XVIII, make one. That is the usual way, is it not?
And the king laughed facetiously.
Oh, sire, replied the minister, we have no occasion to invent any. Every day our desks are loaded with most circumstantial denunciations coming from crowds of individuals who hope for some return for services which they seek to render but cannot. They trust to fortune and rely that some unexpected event will give a kind of reality to their predictions.
Well, sir, go, said Louis XVIII, and remember that I am waiting for you.
I will but go and return, sire. I shall be back in 10 minutes.
And I, sire, said Monsieur de Blacas, will go and find my messenger.
Wait, sir, wait, said Louis XVIII. Really, Monsieur de Blacas, I must change your armorial bearings. I will give you an eagle with outstretched wings, holding in its claws a prey which tries in vain to escape, and bearing this device, Tenax.
Sire, I listen, said de Blacas, biting his nails with impatience.
I wish to consult you on this passage. Molly, Fugius, and Helitu. You know it refers to a stag flying from a wolf. Are you not a sportsman and a great wolf hunter? Well then, what do you think of the Molly and Helitu?
Admirable, sire. But my messenger is like the stag you refer to, for he has posted 220 leagues in little more than 3 days,
which is undergoing great fatigue and anxiety, my dear Duke, when we have a telegraph which corresponds in 3 or 4 hours, and that without putting it the least in the world out of breath.
Ah, sire, you recompense but badly this poor young man who has come so far and with so much ardour to give your majesty useful information. If only for the sake of Monsieur de Salvieux, who recommends him to me, I entreat your majesty to receive him graciously.
Monsieur de Salvieux, my brother's chamberlain?
Yes, sire.
He is at Marseille
and writes me thence.
Does he speak to you of this conspiracy?
No, but strongly recommends Monsieur de Villefort, and begs me to present him to your majesty.
Monsieur de Villefort, cried the king. Is the messenger's name Monsieur de Villefort?
Yes, sire.
And he comes from Marseille?
In person.
Why did you not mention his name at once? Replied the king, betraying some uneasiness.
Sire, I thought his name was unknown to your majesty.
No, no, Blacas. He is a man of strong and elevated understanding, ambitious too, and, pardieu, you know his father's name?
His father?
Yes, Noirtier.
Noirtier the Girondin? Noirtier the senator?
He himself.
And your majesty has employed the son of such a man?
Blacas, my friend, you have but limited comprehension. I told you Villefort was ambitious, and to attain his ambition, Villefort would sacrifice everything, even his father.
Then, sire, may I present him?
This instant, Duke. Where is he?
Waiting below in my carriage.
Seek him at once.
I hasten to do so.
The Duke left the royal presence with the speed of a young man. His really sincere royalism made him youthful again. Louis XVIII remained alone, and turning his eyes on his half-opened Horace, muttered,
"Justum et tenacum propositi virem."
Monsieur de Blacas returned with the same rapidity he had descended, but in the antechamber he was forced to appeal to the king's authority. Villefort's dusty garb, his costume which was not of courtly cut, excited the susceptibility of Monsieur de Brézé, who was all astonishment at finding that this young man had the pretension to enter before the king in such attire. The Duke, however, superseded all difficulties with a word, his majesty's order, and, in spite of the observations which the master of the ceremonies made for the honour of his office and principles, Villefort was introduced. The king was seated in the same place where the Duke had left him. On opening the door, Vifor found himself facing him, and the young magistrate's first impulse was to pause.
"Come in, Monsieur de Vifor," said the king. "Come in."
Vifor bowed, and, advancing a few steps, waited until the king should interrogate him.
"Monsieur de Vifor," said Louis XVIII, "the Duc de Blacas assures me you have some interesting information to communicate. Sire, the Duke is right, and I believe your Majesty will think it equally important. In the first place, and before everything else, sir, is the bad news as great in your opinion as it is wished to make me believe? Sire, I believe it to be most urgent, but I hope, by the speed I have used, that it is not irreparable."
"Speak as fully as you please, sir," said the king, who began to give way to the emotion which had showed itself in Blacas' face and affected Villefort's voice. "Speak, sir, and pray begin at the beginning. I like order in everything."
"Sire," said Villefort, "I will render a faithful report to your majesty, but I must entreat your forgiveness if my anxiety creates some obscurity in my language."
A glance at the king after this discreet and subtle exordium assured Villefort of the benignity of his august auditor, and he continued, "Sire, I have come as rapidly to Paris as possible to inform your majesty that I have discovered in the exercise of my duties not a commonplace and insignificant plot such as is every day got up in the lower ranks of the people and in the army, but an actual conspiracy, a storm which menaces no less than the throne of your majesty. Sire, the usurper is arming 3 ships. He meditates some project which, however mad, is yet perhaps terrible. At this moment he will have left Elba, to go whither I know not, but assuredly to attempt a landing either at Naples or on the coast of Tuscany or perhaps on the shore of France. Your Majesty is well aware that the sovereign of the Isle of Elba has maintained his relations with Italy and France."
"I am, sir," said the king, much agitated. "And recently we have had information that the Bonapartist clubs have had meetings in the Rue Saint-Jacques. But proceed, I beg of you. How did you obtain these details?" "Sire, they are the results of an examination which I have made of a man of Marseille whom I have watched for some time and arrested on the day of my departure.
This person, a sailor of turbulent character, and whom I suspected of Bonapartism, has been secretly to the Isle of Elba. There he saw the Grand Marshal, who charged him with a verbal mission to a Bonapartist in Paris, whose name I could not extract from him. But this mission was to prepare men's minds for a return. It is the man who says this, sire, a return which will soon occur."
"And where is this man?"
"In prison, sire."
"And the matter seems serious to you?"
"So serious, sire, that when the circumstance surprised me in the midst of a family festival on the very day of my betrothal, I left my bride and friends, postponing everything, that I might hasten to lay at your majesty's feet the fears which impressed me, and the assurance of my devotion."
"True," said Louis XVIII. "Was there not a marriage engagement between you and Mademoiselle de Saint-Méran?"
"Daughter of one of your majesty's most faithful servants."
"Yes, yes. But let us talk of this plot, Monsieur de Villefort.
Sire, I fear it is more than a plot. I fear it is a conspiracy."
"A conspiracy in these times," said Louis XVIII, smiling, "is a thing very easy to meditate, but more difficult to conduct to an end. Inasmuch as re-established so recently on the throne of our ancestors, we have our eyes open at once upon the past, the present, and the future. For the last 10 months my ministers have redoubled their vigilance in order to watch the shore of the Mediterranean. If Bonaparte landed at Naples, the whole coalition would be on foot before he could even reach Piombino. If he land in Tuscany, he will be in an unfriendly territory. If he land in France, it must be with a handful of men, and the result of that is easily foretold, execrated as he is by the population. Take courage, sir, but at the same time rely on our royal gratitude."
"And here is Monsieur d'André," cried de Blacas.
At this instant the Minister of Police appeared at the door, pale, trembling, and as if ready to faint. Villefort was about to retire, but Monsieur de Blacas, taking his hand, restrained him. 11. The Corsican Ogre. At the sight of this agitation, Louis XVIII pushed from him violently the table at which he was writing.
"What ails you, Monsieur le Baron?" he exclaimed. "You appear quite aghast. This trouble, this hesitation, have they anything to do with what Monsieur de Blacas has told me, and Monsieur de Villefort has just confirmed?"
Monsieur de Blacas moved suddenly towards the Baron, but the fright of the courtier precluded the triumph of the statesman, and besides, as matters were, it was much more to his advantage that the prefect of police should triumph over him than that he should humiliate the prefect.
"Sire," stammered the Baron. "Well, what is it?" asked Louis XVIII.
The Minister of Police, giving way to an impulse of despair, was about to throw himself at the feet of Louis XVIII, who retreated a step and frowned.
"Will you speak?" he said. "Oh, sire, what a dreadful misfortune. I am indeed to be pitied. I can never forgive myself."
"Monsieur," said Louis XVIII,
"I command you to speak."
"Well, sire, the usurper left Elba on the 26th February and landed on the 1st of March."
"And where? In Italy?"
asked the king eagerly.
"In France, sire, at a small port near Antibes in the Gulf of Juan." "The usurper landed in France near Antibes in the Gulf of Juan, 250 leagues from Paris on the 1st of March, and you only acquired this information today, the 4th of March? Well, sir, what you tell me is impossible. You must have received a false report, or you have gone mad. Alas, sire, it is but too true."
Louis made a gesture of indescribable anger and alarm, and then drew himself up as if this sudden blow had struck him at the same moment in heart and countenance.
"In France?" he cried. "The usurper in France? Then they did not watch over this man. Who knows, they were perhaps in league with him." "Oh, sire," exclaimed the Duc de Blacas, "Monsieur d'André is not a man to be accused of treason. Sire, we have all been blind, and the Minister of Police has shared the general blindness, that is all."
"But," said Villefort, and then suddenly checking himself, he was silent. Then he continued, "Your pardon, sire," he said, bowing. "My zeal carried me away. Will your majesty deign to excuse me?"
"Speak, sir, speak boldly," replied Louis. "You alone forewarned us of the evil. Now try and aid us with the remedy."
"Sire," said Villefort, "the usurper is detested in the south, and it seems to me that if he ventured into the south, it would be easy to raise Languedoc and Provence against him."
"Yes, assuredly," replied the minister, "but he is advancing by Gap and Sisteron." "Advancing? He is advancing?" said Louis XVIII. "Is he then advancing on Paris?"
The Minister of Police kept a silence which was equivalent to a complete avowal.
"And Dauphine, sir?" inquired the King of Villefort. "Do you think it possible to rouse that as well as Provence?"
"Sire, I am sorry to tell your Majesty a cruel fact, but the feeling in Dauphine is far from resembling that of Provence or Languedoc. The mountaineers are Bonapartists, sire."
"Then," murmured Louis, "he was well informed. And how many men had he with him?"
"I do not know, sire," answered the Minister of Police.
"What? You do not know? Have you neglected to obtain information of this circumstance?"
"It is true, this is of small importance," he added with a withering smile.
"Sire, it was impossible to learn. The despatch simply stated the fact of the landing and the route taken by the usurper." "And how did this despatch reach you?" inquired the king.
The minister bowed his head, and whilst a deep colour overspread his cheeks, he stammered out,
"By the telegraph, sire."
Louis XVIII advanced a step and folded his arms over his chest, as Napoleon would have done.
"So then," he exclaimed, turning pale with anger, "7 conjoined and allied armies overthrew that man. A miracle of heaven replaced me on the throne of my fathers after 25 years of exile. I have, during those 25 years, studied, sounded, analyzed the men and things of that France which was promised to me.
and when I have attained the end of all my wishes, the power I hold in my hands bursts and shatters me to atoms.
Sire, it is fatality, murmured the minister, feeling that such a pressure, however light for destiny, was sufficient to overwhelm a man.
What our enemies say of us is then true. We have learnt nothing, forgotten nothing. If I were betrayed as he was, I would console myself. But to be in the midst of persons elevated by myself to dignities who ought to watch over me more preciously than over themselves, for my fortune is theirs. Before me they were nothing, after me they will be nothing, and perish miserably from incapacity, ineptitude. Oh, yes, sir, you are right. It is fatality.
The minister was bowed beneath this crushing sarcasm. Monsieur de Blacas wiped the moisture from his brow. Villefort smiled within himself, for he felt his increased importance.
To fall, continued King Louis, who at the first glance had sounded the abyss on which the monarchy hung suspended. To fall, and learn that fall by the telegraph? Oh, I would rather mount the scaffold of my brother Louis the 16th than thus descend the staircase of the Tuileries, driven away by ridicule. Ridicule, sir? Why, you know not its power in France, and yet you ought to know it.
Sire, sire, murmured the minister.
For pity's approach, Monsieur de Villefort, resumed the king, addressing the young man who, motionless and breathless, was listening to a conversation on which depended the destiny of a kingdom.
Approach, and tell Monsieur that it is possible to know beforehand all that he has not known.
Sire, it was really impossible to learn secrets which that man concealed from all the world.
Really impossible.
Yes, that is a great word, sir. Unfortunately, there are great words as there are great men. I have measured them. Really impossible for a minister who has an office, agents, spies, and 1,500,000 francs for secret service money to know what is going on at 60 leagues from the coast of France.
Well then, see, here is a gentleman who had none of these resources at his disposal. A gentleman, only a simple magistrate, who learned more than you with all your police, and who would have saved my crown if, like you, he had the power of directing a telegraph.
The look of the Minister of Police was turned with concentrated spite on Villefort, who bent his head with the modesty of triumph.
I do not mean that for you, Blacas, continued Louis the 18th, for if you have discovered nothing, at least you have had the good sense to persevere in your suspicions. Any other than yourself would have considered the disclosure of Monsieur de Villefort as insignificant, or else dictated by a venal ambition.
These words were meant to allude to those which the Minister of Police had uttered with so much confidence an hour before. Villefort understood the drift of the king. Any other person would perhaps have been too much overcome by the intoxication of praise, but he feared to make for himself a mortal enemy of the police minister, although he perceived Dondre was irrevocably lost. In fact, the minister, who, in the plenitude of his power, had been unable to penetrate Napoleon's secret, might, in the convulsions of his dying throes, penetrate his, Villefort's, secret, for which end he had but to interrogate Dantès. He therefore came to the rescue of the crestfallen minister, instead of aiding to crush him.
"Sire," said Villefort, "the rapidity of the event must prove to your majesty that God alone can prevent it by raising a tempest. What your majesty is pleased to attribute to me as profound perspicacity is simply owing to chance, and I have profited by that chance like a good and devoted servant, that's all. Do not attribute to me more than I deserve, sire, that your majesty may never have occasion to recall the first opinion you have been pleased to form of me."
The Minister of Police thanked the young man by an eloquent look, and Villefort understood that he had succeeded in his design, that is to say, that without forfeiting the gratitude of the king, he had made a friend of one on whom, in case of necessity, he might rely.
"'Tis well," resumed the king. "And now, gentlemen," he continued, turning towards Monsieur de Blacas and the Minister of Police,
I have no further occasion for you, and you may retire. What now remains to do is in the department of the Minister of War.
Fortunately, sire, said Monsieur de Blacas, we can rely on the army. Your Majesty knows how every report confirms their loyalty and attachment.
Do not mention reports, sir, to me, for I know now what confidence to place in them.
Yet, apropos of reports, Monsieur le Baron, what intelligence have you as to our affair in the Rue Saint-Jacques?
The affair in the Rue Saint-Jacques? Exclaimed Villefort, unable to repress an exclamation. Then, suddenly pausing, he added, Your pardon, sire, but my devotion to your Majesty has made me forget not the respect I have, for that is too deeply engraven in my heart, but the rules of etiquette.
Say and act, sir, replied the king. You have acquired the right to inquire.
Sire, replied the Minister of Police, I came this moment to give your Majesty fresh information which I had obtained on this head, when your Majesty's attention was attracted by this terrible affair of the Gulf, and now these facts will cease to interest your Majesty.
On the contrary, sir, on the contrary, said Louis XVIII, this affair seems to me to have a decided connection with that which occupies our attention, and the death of General Canel will, perhaps, put us on the direct track of a great internal conspiracy.
At the name of General Canel, Villefort trembled.
All combined, sir, said the Minister of Police, to ensure the probability that this death is not the result of a suicide, as we at first believed, but of an assassination. General Canel had quitted, as it appears, a Bonapartist club when he disappeared. An unknown person had been with him that morning and made an appointment with him in the Rue Saint-Jacques. Unfortunately, the general's valet de chambre, who was dressing his hair at the moment when the stranger entered, heard the street mentioned, but did not catch the number.
As the police minister related this to the king, Villefort, who seemed as if his very existence hung on his lips, turned alternately red and pale. The king looked towards him.
Do you not think with me, Monsieur de Villefort, that General Canel, whom they believed attached to the usurper, but who was really entirely devoted to me, has perished the victim of a Bonapartist ambush?
It is probable, sire, replied Villefort. But is this all that is known?
They are on the traces of the man who appointed the meeting with him.
On his traces, said Villefort.
Yes, the servant has given his description. He is a man of from 50 to 52 years of age, brown, with black eyes covered with shaggy eyebrows, and a thick moustache. He was dressed in a blue frock coat, buttoned up to the chin, and wore at his buttonhole the rosette of an officer of the Legion of Honour. Yesterday an individual was followed exactly corresponding with this description, but he was lost sight of at the corner of the Rue de la Jussienne and the Rue Coq Héron.
Villefort leaned on the back of an armchair, for in proportion as the Minister of Police spoke, he felt his legs bend under him. But when he learnt that the unknown had escaped the vigilance of the agent who followed him, he breathed again.
"Continue to seek for this man, sir," said the king to the Minister of Police. "For if, as all conspires to convince me, General Canel, who would have been so useful to us at the moment, has been murdered, his assassins, Bonapartists or not, shall be cruelly punished."
It required all Villefort's sang-froid not to betray the terror with which this declaration of the king inspired him.
"How strange," continued the king with some asperity, "the police thinks all is said when it says, a murder has been committed, and particularly when it adds, and we are on the trace of the guilty persons. Sire, your Majesty will, I trust, be amply satisfied on this point at least. We shall see. I will no longer detain you, Baron. Monsieur de Villefort, you must be fatigued after so long a journey. Go and repose yourself. Of course you stopped at your father's."
A faintness came over Villefort.
No, sire, he replied. I alighted at the Hotel de Madrid in the Rue de Tournon. But you have seen him.
Sire, I went straight to the Duc de Blacas.
But you will see him then.
I think not, sire.
Ah, I forgot, said Louis, smiling in a manner which proved that all these questions were not made without a motive. I forgot you and Monsieur Noirtier are not on the best terms possible, and that this is another sacrifice made to the royal cause, and for which you should be recompensed.
Sire, the kindness your majesty deigns to evince towards me is a recompense which so far surpasses my utmost ambition that I have nothing more to request.
Never mind, sir. We will not forget you. Make your mind easy.
In the meanwhile, the king here detached the cross of the Legion of Honor he usually wore over his blue coat near the cross of Saint Louis above the order of Notre Dame de Mont Carmel and Saint Lazare and gave it to Villefort.
In the meanwhile, take this cross.
Sire, said Villefort, your majesty mistakes. This cross is that of an officer.
Ma foi, said Louis the 18th. Take it such as it is, for I have not the time to procure you another. Blacas, let it be your care to see that the brevet is made out and sent to Monsieur de Villefort.
Villefort's eyes were filled with tears of joy and pride. He took the cross and kissed it. And now, he said, may I inquire what are the orders with which your majesty deigns to honour me?
Take what rest you require, and remember that, unable to serve me here in Paris, you may be of the greatest service to me at Marseille.
Sire, replied Villefort, bowing, in an hour I shall have quitted Paris.
Go, sir, said the king, and should I forget you, king's memories are short, do not be afraid to bring yourself to my recollection. Monsieur le Baron, send for the Minister of War. Blacas, remain.
Ah, sir, said the Minister of Police to Villefort as they left the Tuileries,
you enter by the right door, and your fortune is made.
Will it be long first? Muttered Villefort, saluting the minister whose career was ended, and looking about him for a hackney coach. One passed at the moment which he hailed. He gave his address to the driver, and springing in, threw himself on the seat and gave loose to dreams of ambition. 10 minutes afterwards, Villefort reached his hotel, ordered his horses in 2 hours, and desired to have his breakfast brought to him. He was about to commence his repast when the sound of the bell, rung by a free and firm hand, was heard. The valet opened the door, and Villefort heard his name pronounced.
"Who could know that I was here already?" said the young man. The valet entered.
"Well," said Villefort, "what is it? Who rang? Who asked for me?
A stranger who will not send in his name. A stranger who will not send in his name? What can he want with me? He wishes to speak to you."
"To me?"
"Yes."
"Did he mention my name?"
"Yes."
"What sort of person is he?"
"Why, sir, a man of about 50,
short or tall."
"About your own height, sir."
"Dark or fair?"
"Dark, very dark, with black eyes, black hair, black eyebrows."
"And how dressed?" asked Villefort quickly.
"In a blue frock coat, buttoned up close, decorated with the Legion of Honor."
"It is he," said Villefort, turning pale.
"Hey, pardieu," said the individual whose description we have twice given, entering the door. "What a great deal of ceremony. Is it the custom in Marseille for sons to keep their fathers waiting in their anterooms?"
"Father," cried Villefort, "then I was not deceived. I felt sure it must be you."
"Well, then, if you felt so sure," replied the newcomer, putting his cane in a corner and his hat on a chair, "allow me to say, my dear Gerard, that it was not very filial of you to keep me waiting at the door."
"Leave us, Chamin," said Villefort. The servant quitted the apartment with evident signs of astonishment.
12. Father and Son. Monsieur Noirtier, for it was indeed he who entered, followed with his eyes the servant until he had closed the door, and then, fearing no doubt that he might be overheard in the antechamber, he opened the door again. Nor was the precaution useless, as appeared from the rapid retreat of Germain, who proved that he was not exempt from the sin which ruined our first parents. Monsieur Noirtier then took the trouble to close carefully the door of the antechamber, then that of the bedchamber, and then extended his hand to Villefort, who had followed all his motions with surprise, which he could not conceal.
"Well, now, my dear Gerard," said he to the young man with a very significant look,
Do you know you seem as if you were not very glad to see me?
My dear father, said Vifor, I am on the contrary delighted, but I so little expected your visit that it has somewhat overcome me.
But, my dear fellow, replied Monsieur Noirtier, seating himself, I might say the same thing to you. When you announced to me your wedding for the 28th of February, and on the 4th of March,